Okay, guy.
Okay, I got it. That's being recorded, and I'm going to share my little PowerPoint just with a few points. And let me get it to actually start. It is starting, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, welcome to the January 2024 monthly lecture meeting of the National Capital Astronomers, and here are your officers, and we will see. We have in attendance Elizabeth Warner, the webmaster, Jeffrey Norman, our assistant secretary treasurer, and John Hornstein, our president, and myself, the president. I don't know if is Todd, are you here?
Yes,
Jim
he is.
Simpson is here. Okay, good. And Jim, you here?
Yeah, here.
Okay, so if anybody is new to this, our meetings are always free and open to the public, and you can join pretty much anytime. Do it online at capitalastronomers.org. The dues are only $10 a year for adults, and they're going to go up to $15 in June. So, a little bit hard to do show of hands. I'm not going to bother with that, but I know some of you may have been members in the past, or and we'd love to have you rejoin again. If you haven't joined, it's not a whole lot, and you get some benefits. Let's see. As a club, we need a new Washington meetup organizer for Exploring the Sky, which won't start until April. It'll start 2 days before the eclipse. And we need additional ways of notifying the public about Exploring the Sky, which is our main club organized public outreach thing, although we do things down at Air and Space Museum from time to time. But it used to be that the Exploring the Sky and other similar events would be in the Washington Post on the first week of each month, but they're not putting that in the print edition anymore. And we've got a very nice Solar Max scope, and I'd love for people to sign it out and use it. And we need a new vice president to find speakers and candidates for office for the next year. You may have noticed that Vera Rubin, who was a member of NCA, member when she was young, has been in the news. And that there's details on that in the in Stardust. And here is the eclipse glasses, and I'm just about finalized this. I went to a whole bunch of different places that do customized eyeglasses for eclipses, and the one that I think Sue Bassett suggested, and some other people suggested, they're not doing customized ones. They'll only do the generic ones, and then you can pay more for a sticker, and then somebody has to put little stickers on them. And I didn't think that was really a winner. So these are going to cost about $1.20 a pair for 500. You buy them in batches of 500. So I think my last statement here is incorrect. We've decided we're going to give them away. Okay, and here's the invoice. Okay, come on. There we go. And I haven't paid it yet, but I hope that's okay with the people. And I think when we have the solar scope out on the daytime, somebody looks through there, if they're interested, they should get a set of glasses. And let's see. And I have on hand a number of lenses that you can make a different type of solar viewer, where you actually get an enlarged image of the sun, and you can actually see not the neat stuff on the chromosphere that you can see with a hydrogen alpha filter, but you do see sunspots. And I think the lenses cost like $10 or something like that. That's all I have. And by the way, if you're wondering why I'm dressed like this, as I explained to other people, I got up to the Hopewell Observatory this evening shortly before I needed to log on. And we don't keep the heat on in the observatory when we're not up here. So it's slowly warming up. So, any other announcements from anybody? Okay, Elizabeth has raised her hand.
So I have a question. So for VP to replace John Hornstein, you said that he finds the speakers, which I knew that the VP did that. But since when was it the VP's responsibility to put together the slate of nominees for elections? That was supposed to be done by a nominating committee that's put together by the president of the club.
Okay, well, yeah, you may be right. But in past years, the committee has not really functioned. And
That's because I
so
don't think the
John has
committee has been
picked it.
pulled together.
That's true. Well, okay. Well, that would mean,
And so then that's why the VP was getting dumped on because the president, it's been a couple of years since they've called a committee together to do the nominate to pull together the slate, but John
probably
has
more than a
nicely,
couple.
yeah, more than a couple. John has stepped up nicely to make sure that we have are able to have elections and such. So, but I think that we need to get back to. It should be a committee that pulls together the slate.
You're right.
So,
We have time to do that. I will make sure that happens. Thank you
good,
for this
great.
reminder and suggestion.
Nancy
Yes,
has
Nancy.
I held practically every office in NCA when I was down there, but of all of them, nothing was more gratifying than being vice president. I dealt with these speakers who, I admit, I was in awe of a lot of them. And they were so gracious and so encouraging and helpful. It was just one of the best experiences in NCA. I recommend it to anybody who would be interested in trying it.
Okay. Thank you. Any other announcements? Okay. I'll turn this over to John.
Okay. It's a great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, Shubham Kanodia. He's a postdoctoral scientist in the Earth and Planets Laboratory of the Carnegie Institution in Washington. And his current research focuses on detecting and characterizing giant exoplanets around M dwarf stars and on understanding how these extreme systems form. He also looks for habitable planets. Don't let the name M dwarf star fool you. Small does not mean well behaved. The behavior of an M dwarf star is to the behavior of our sun as the behavior of a human 2-year-old is to the behavior of a human adult. Dr. Kanodia obtained his PhD at the Penn State Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics, and from his PhD research onwards, he has been intensively involved with developing and then using new ground-based spectrographs that can measure the component of an astronomical object's velocity along our line of sight to the object by measuring redshifts or blue shifts of the object spectrum. Measurements of changes in that velocity can detect planets or show that lo what looked like a single star is actually part of a pair of co-orbiting stars, and large changing velocities of objects around what seems to be empty space can reveal the presence of a black hole. Dr. Kanodia also develops innovative statistical techniques for characterizing the population of planets around M dwarf stars. And that's a very important activity scientifically. He uses data from the James Webb Space Telescope as well as data from ground-based telescopes. He has also done an enormous amount of mentoring and outreach at all grade levels, ranging from middle school to graduate school. Quite admirably, he volunteered his time to teach English and math to middle school students in Mumbai, which is the city in India whose name we used to translate, literate as Bombay. And that's really a very worthwhile thing to have volunteered time for. Dr. Kanodia.
Thank you, John. Thank you for that really wonderful introduction and also for having me here. Can people hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, it's a great pleasure to be here. I think I had looked up the NCA website shortly after I moved to DC, and I had found the monthly events that are held at Rock Creek Park. I wanted to come and visit, but I think they hadn't resumed because this was still in the midst of the pandemic when I moved to DC. So it's definitely, I think, a great honor to be giving a talk over here in this group. All right, so I will get started. So I'm going to be talking about giant exoplanets. So basically objects like Jupiter and Saturn in our solar system, around these really small red stars. So that's what this picture on the right is showing. So we have stars like the sun, which are called the G-type stars, but then we have stars that are much smaller than the sun that are called M-dwarfs. And the purpose of my research is to look for planets that orbit these types of stars, and in particular look for giant exoplanets that orbit these types of stars, because they represent a really interesting regime of planet formation. And I think they have a lot of secrets they can tell us about how planets form in general. So that's going to be the topic that I'll be talking about today. So let's just get started. All right, and I guess I should definitely mention that what I'm going to talk about today is definitely not something that I've done by myself. It involves a huge group of people spanning multiple different places, ranging from Carnegie, Penn State, wherever I did my grad school, and a whole number of different places, both in the US and also in other countries. All right, let me just hide this. Okay, so I guess the key question that we think about is that the latest count of confirmed exoplanets is, I don't know, something like 5,000, 5,500 or so. So why do we really need to find more? Do we already know everything there is to know about exoplanets? We've been doing this for about, the first exoplanet was 1995, that was discovered around a solar type star. So it's been almost 30 years since we've discovered exoplanets, and we've been basically going after it pretty hard since then. So what do we know in the last 30 years, and what are the gaps in our understanding that we really need to fill and build upon? So while there are these so many exoplanets, I think what we're doing right now is we are still building new tools that are telling us and giving us more information about types of planets and different regions of parameter space where we didn't have them before. So in particular, I'll be talking about our results from this satellite on the right, which is the TESS mission that NASA's Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite. And then I really like this image on the left, which is actually the last image taken of James Webb Space Telescope as it was leaving Earth. So James Webb Space Telescope, JWST, is now at L2. So it's pretty far from us, and we can't really image it directly and at least resolve it directly. So this is the last image as it was being launched by the European Space Agency Ariane mission, Ariane rocket. And I think that's just a really a nice way to introduce the rocket, the telescope. All right. So before I get into the crux of my research, let me just make sure that we're all on the same page. So here I'm showing an HR diagram, a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. And this can get quite complicated, but I think the main thing to take away from this is on the y-axis, on the vertical side, we have how bright the star is, the luminosity of the star. So anything on the upper side is brighter. Anything on the lower side is fainter. It's just going to be harder to see. And then the x-axis is the color. So being astronomers, anything that's hotter is blue. Anything that's fainter and cooler is red. So the sun is shown with the sun, which is a G-type star over here. And the objects that I focus on are basically these M dwarfs. So these are pretty much the bottom end of this main sequence. They're as red as you can go, as cold as you can go, and still burn hydrogen into helium. So these really cold stars, for just to throw a number, they're about 3,000 Kelvin, which is about half the temperature of the sun. In radius and mass, they range from about 10% to 50% that of the sun. So they're really small stars. So the question really comes down to, why do we bother studying these really faint stars, which in principle should be hard, right? Because the fainter the object is, it's going to be harder to study it. And the key, I think what's really interesting to reinforce in the beginning of the talk is that these stars are really, really small. And by when I say that, how small is that? So here's a graphic to perhaps convey that in a slightly more effective manner. So on the left, I have the sun, which is shown over here. And then in the middle, I have what is essentially an M dwarf, a mid M dwarf. So M dwarfs span a range of sizes, but let's just take the average. So a mid M dwarf is not that much more massive than a brown dwarf, which is pretty much the same size as a Jupiter. So Jupiter, a brown dwarf, and a late M dwarf are pretty much the same size to maybe 10 or 20%. The difference between them is that a brown dwarf is much more massive than a Jupiter, and an M dwarf is much more massive than a brown dwarf. So the difference in mass when an object gets heavier, when you just keep feeding it more and more gas, is when it basically goes from being a planet to being a brown dwarf, where it can burn hydrogen to helium, or rather burn deuterium to helium. And then you keep adding more mass, and that's where you, instead of burning deuterium, you're now massive enough that you can actually fuse hydrogen to helium, and you're basically a star, which is producing its own light. So that's basically the distinction between the conventional stars we study, like the sun, and these M dwarfs, which are much smaller, fainter, and because they are so small and faint, they burn very little fuel at a time. And what that means is, because they're going about their life so slowly, their ages are really, really long. So they basically live for trillions of years. So any M dwarf that has been born so far, that has been formed in the universe, has never died. So for all intents and purposes, essentially, they're just immortal, I guess, in some sense. So what that means is, planets that form around these types of stars have a very different process, a procedure for formation, but more importantly, a very different procedure for evolution. Because when the sun forms, it takes a few million years to form, and then it lives in its adolescence, in its teenage phase, for a few tens of millions of years. But these M dwarfs are living their teenage and their youth for like hundreds of millions of years, and in some cases, even 1 billion years. So planets have a very, very different life cycle, evolutionary lifespan, when it comes to being formed and surviving around M dwarf stars. So that's one reason. So Earth doesn't orbit an M dwarf. I think we all know that. So why do we bother studying these planets? If our ultimate goal in astronomy and exoplanets, I think there are two of them. One is to understand how the Earth formed, and the second is to look for life, to actually try and find life in the universe around these exoplanets. So why do we bother studying these M dwarf planets? And I think the key comes to, if we went out, and not in DC, but slightly a slightly darker side, if you could see the night sky, this is hopefully what we would see. Tons and tons of stars. But most of them would be white or blue, rather. These would be really hot stars that we see. But oops, if our eye was slightly larger and slightly more sensitive in the red, just slightly, what we would see is actually this. Our night sky would be completely different if only we had eyes that were slightly more sensitive in the red. And the reason for that is because for every star in the night sky that we are seeing with the naked eye, there's about 10 of them that we cannot see. Not because they are further away, they're much closer, in fact. But the only reason we cannot see them is because they are much fainter, smaller, and colder. So they're red. And that's what I'm showing over here. If we could see that, we would be seeing this version of the night sky. It would be much, much redder. And it would be full of these really, really red stars, these M dwarfs. They form like 75% of the galaxy. So if we're really trying to understand planet formation, form like a picture of how planets form in general, we need to understand what's going on these types of stars. So red, faint, many, many, many of them. I think that's the key takeaway here. But the interesting thing is because they're so small, in principle, it should be easy to find planets around them. So as John was mentioning, one of the techniques I use is the radial velocity technique, which basically relies on taking the light from the star, splitting it into its spectrum. And that's what's shown on the bottom over here. So we're seeing the atomic lines that have been are split up after taking the spectrum. And as the star is moving, because the planet has some mass and it's causing the star to wobble back and forth, we see those lines moving back and forth. Now, because the M dwarf star is much smaller than the sun, these lines would move a lot more than for a similar planet around the sun. So basically, it's like if you were pulling an elephant by its tail, you would be moving it a lot less than if you're pulling a dog by its tail. I mean, I wouldn't say you should do that, but basically you can have a lot more force and you can do a lot more for a smaller object than a much more massive object. And that's what we're seeing. The planets are pulling the M-dwarfs by their tail and they're causing the M-dwarfs to dance a lot more than the sun is doing. And therefore, in principle, it should be easier to find planets around M-dwarfs. So the question is, it should be easier to find them. But what do the planets themselves look like? We think these stars, we know for a fact that these stars are many. They form the bulk of the galaxy. But what do we know about the planets that orbit these types of stars? And I think the key over there is that our theoretical predictions suggest that planet formation should be very different around these types of stars because the stars are smaller. The disks, the protoplanetary disks in which planets form should be different. And the timescale of formation should be very different. But not just theory, it's also empirical evidence which suggests that the planets around these types of stars are very different, and at least the small planets. So on the right, I have a plot which is from the Kepler mission, which is also a transiting planet detection mission, which found a whole bunch of small planets around solar-type stars, which is G-type stars, K and M, and so on. And I think the key result that's shown in this plot is that when it comes to M dwarfs, there's many, many more small planets than we have around the sun. So basically, if you take an average M dwarf, on average, it's going to have more small planets than an average solar type star. So we know that both from transits and radial velocity, the Doppler surveys, which have basically confirmed this, that at least when it comes to small planets, the M dwarf planets seem to be very different from those around our solar type stars. But I think, as you could probably guess from the title of my talk, what I'm interested about is the giant planets. What are the giant planets around M dwarfs? What are the giant planets around solar type stars? And are they similar or are they different? What's going on around them? And I think so that's why I introduced this new acronym, GEMS, and that stands for giant exoplanets around M dwarf stars. And because I'm at Carnegie, but a lot of folks also work on earth sciences, geology. I have to distinguish by when I'm saying gems, this is not the crystalline gems we think about in the earth, but these are these giant exoplanets around M dwarf stars that I'm talking about. And I think up until recently, and by recently, I mean like 2018 or so, we just knew about two or three of them. And that was enough for us to start doing some very, very basic statistics to see what their properties look like. But up until now, and up until like a few years back, we didn't really have enough of a sample to get a lot of fidelity in terms of comparative statistics. What did their properties look like within the sample of M dwarf stars and compared to that with the FGK stars? So what we're trying to do as part of my work is increase the sample. So if we take all the confirmed exoplanets that we know of today, which is about 5,500 or so, just about 10% of them orbit these M dwarf stars. So as I said, the M dwarf stars are about 3 to 4,000 Kelvin, so much cooler than the sun. And despite the fact that it should be easier to find these planets because the stars are smaller, because the stars are so faint and so red, in principle, that has not happened because of those reasons. This is difficult. And another way to show this is, again, if I show the energy that the sun is putting out as a function of wavelength, so we have the visible that's in the gray and the energy of the sun. And I guess it's not a evolutionary coincidence that our eyes are optimized to capture most of the sun's light. So we have, most of our traditional instruments have been limited to the visible, because they're looking for planets around solar type stars. And if they're doing that, they're basically getting a view of the sky as is shown now, is move from here to the image on the right, which is actually what's a better a depiction of reality, where you have all these red faint stars. And that's what's shown with this red curve over here, that if we wanted to study M dwarfs, we need to capture light from much, much redder, from the near infrared, which is shown here. So you can, I don't know if this, so for example, we are going from 4,000 to 7,000 angstroms, so 400 to 700 nanometers in the visible, but these mid-M dwarfs peak at about a micron, so they're much redder than the sun. And because the M dwarf span a large range of temperatures, you have early M dwarfs just slightly hotter and are shown in orange. So what we really need to do is build instruments that cover this range of wavelengths, because we're capturing most of the light from the star then, going from the visible to the near infrared and beyond. And that's what I did as part of my PhD at Penn State. So we built these two instruments. So on the left is NUID. NUID rhymes with fluid, basically. And it was an instrument that was funded by NASA and NSF to find planets around G-type stars, that's the sun, and early M dwarfs, so basically span the entire range. And therefore, it has a very large wavelength coverage. And then the other instrument we built, which was actually the first one we made, was the Habitable Zone Planet Finder, or HPF, which was a purpose-built instrument to find planets around mid to late M dwarfs. So because they're finding planets around mid to late M dwarfs, which are much redder, you can see that the wavelength is redder than the visible. It's about 830 nanometers to about 1300 nanometers, or about 1.3 microns. So the reason we did this is because including these two instruments, we can now cover the wavelength regime, which was hitherto basically out of reach of our traditional instruments. So let me just spend a couple minutes getting into further detail about these instruments. So HPF, or the Habitable Zone Planet Finder, is a near-infrared spectrograph, which is located at the 10-meter Hobby-Everly Telescope in West Texas, in fact. So we were just discussing Texas. So the Hobby-Everly Telescope is at McDonald Observatory, so it's pretty much at the southern, southwestern end of Texas, pretty close to the, not pretty close, it's about 3 hours from El Paso, which is pretty close to the Mexican border. And this is a view of the night sky from McDonald. It's a really, really good sky site for astronomy, because it's one of the darkest skies in the US. And because these M dwarfs are so faint, we really need a large telescope. And that's what we have with the Hobby-Everly Telescope in McDonald's. So it's a 10-meter telescope, which is what is shown on the right. And on the left, we see the insides of the instrument when we were commissioning the instrument. For some sense of scale, the instrument is about the size of like a car, like a big SUV, essentially. So that's how this big the instrument is. And the reason we need that is because it needs to take the light from this big telescope and then split it into its spectrum so that we can perform the Doppler technique and measure the velocity of the star. And HPF is the most precise near-infrared instrument on sky right now. And for reference, it can achieve precisions on the order of about 1.5 meters per second. And the reason this was the goal, about reaching a meter, meter and a half per second, is because the goal of the instrument is to find Earth-sized planets, Earth-mass planets, in the habitable zones of M dwarfs. So when it comes to M dwarf stars, Earth-sized planets and Earth-mass planets have a Doppler amplitude of about a meter and a half per second. So that's what motivated the precision requirements on this instrument. And then moving from there to NUID. So NUID is basically located at Kitt Peak in Arizona, which is a land that belongs to the Tohono O'odham Nation. And in their language, NUID rhymes with fluid. And it means to discover, or basically to be able to visualize and see. And because it's a great privilege to be able to perform these observations on this Kitt Peak land, which is very, very sacred to them, we decided to honor that legacy while naming the instrument. So it's located at the 3.5 meter wind telescope, and we started doing science about 3 years back. And as you can see from this image on the right top, It basically spans the entire visible and it goes a bit further red. So it goes from about 400 nanometers to about a micron. And with these two instruments, we can now start to find M dwarf planets because their wavelengths are sensitive to the region in which these stars emit most of their light. So that's the part of the talk that I was going to very briefly touch upon the instrumentation. And if there are any questions about these instruments, just feel free to jump in right now. You can also ask them later. So I'll just pause for a few seconds in case there are any questions. Okay.
So you're...
Please go ahead. I'm sorry for the background noise. I don't know if that's audible, but yeah.
So you're now, the instruments are now going from all the way from basically blue into like 1.3 microns. Wow.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I should definitely clarify the fact that these are not at the same location. So these are two completely distinct instruments. But yes, we are able to, with NuIT, for example, we go from about 390 nanometers to about a micron, about 930 nanometers, so almost to a micron. And then HPF goes from about 830 nanometers to about 1300 nanometers. So using a combination of HPF and NuIT, we are able to span a wavelength range of almost three octaves, going from 4,000 to 13,000 angstroms, which is much, much larger than what we were able to do with the conventional visible light spectrographs like HARPS or PFS. Yep.
Thank you.
Sure. And I'll be happy to go into any further details about these instruments if there are any questions. I also have some slides, I think, if folks are interested. But I thought I'll keep the talk slightly broader and cover a few more topics and engage the interest that way. All right. So we have these instruments now that I just referred to. So we have the instrumentation part checked. But the next part is statistics. And I think John also mentioned this. A lot of what I like to do is ensure that not only can we detect these planets, but when we do, we can do justice to the samples of planets we are detecting. And the way we do that, at least for some exoplanets, is using mass radius relationships. So if we have a transiting planet for which we can measure its mass, we can put it on one of these diagrams where we know its radius and its mass. So the x-axis is how heavy it is, the y-axis is how large it is. So the larger the planet, the less dense it will be. So that's what's shown over here. Basically, if you have a planet of a given mass and you keep increasing its radius, that means it's lower and lower density, which means it has lesser and lesser rock. Perhaps it has more ice, more hydrogen, more helium. And basically the density gives us a first order estimate of the composition, as you can see in this plot. But the other utility of mass radius relationships is that you can use them to predict one quantity from the other. So this was one of the early works by Chen and Kipping back about 2016, where what you can see is that for the most bit, and back then we didn't have 5,000 exoplanets, but back then we had about 1,000 exoplanets, most of them followed this straight line. So such that if you have a planet that's about the mass of Earth, and that's what's shown with the symbol over here, it roughly has a radius of the Earth. If you have a planet that's about 10 times the mass of the Earth, it has a radius of about 2 or 3 Earth radii. And for the most part, they follow in log space these linear models. And you can use that to predict one quantity from the other. But as we are building upon our sample of exoplanets, as we're discovering more and more of them and more diverse exoplanets around M-dwarfs, around solar type stars, which are much colder and so on, what we're starting to see is that the simple power law does not hold anymore. And therefore, what I did was I helped develop these non-parametric relationships. And again, I won't go into too much detail about this right now, but please feel free to ask questions later. But I think the best way to think about this is if I plot all my planets in a mass radius plane, same as before, and the color is just now showing how common or how many planets there are in a particular mass radius plane. So here I'm showing M dwarf planets, which are essentially in the background, in the color scheme, is the population density. So blue is where there are more planets, red is where there are fewer planets. And that's what I'm using to fit my mass radius relationship and then use that to predict mass from radii and so on. But this is fairly complicated, and if people are interested in the mathematics behind it, I can certainly go into that. But what we essentially use are these beta polynomials, which is shown over here. And a combination of that and normal density functions, like the Gaussian function, lets you model this distribution while taking into account the measurement uncertainty. So using that, we've developed this framework called Merexo, which allows us to do that. But more importantly, it allows us to expand this from two dimensions of mass radii to also modeling the properties of the planets as a function of the stellar properties. So if you picture this as a 2D plane, now think of it as a third dimension, like a cube, that the third dimension is the mass of the star or the temperature of the planet or so on. So we can now start to search for dependencies of the mass radius plane on the stellar, on the orbital properties of the planet. And I think that's really important because back in the days of Kepler, which was about, let's say, 5 to 10 years back, most of the planets we had discovered were around solar-type stars. So for all intents and purposes, we could practically ignore the stellar dependence because most of the planets are orbiting a very, very similar host star. But now that we have these instruments like HBF, NUER, that are starting to find planets around M-dwarfs, it's not so trivial to just ignore the fact that your star, your host star, is about half the temperature of the sun, about 10% the mass of the sun. And basically, it's a completely different regime of planet formation. So we really need to be careful when we're starting to perform these statistics and comparative analysis. And that's what we're doing now. So we have the instruments, we have the statistics. So let's go find some planets and make some sense of them. So as I said, the purpose of my talk is to talk about GEMS, which are, as a reminder, giant exoplanets around M-dwarf stars. And this is an artist's depiction of one of these giant exoplanets. And you can see how large it is compared to the host star, like a Jupiter-sized object orbiting a star that's just about maybe 4 or 5 times more larger than it. And as a reminder, we're using HBF, which is a near-infrared instrument, and NUET, which is an optical instrument. But I think the key over here is not just these RV spectrographs, these Doppler spectrographs, but NASA's TESS mission, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. And as a reminder, so this is the satellite that was launched back in 2017 or 2018, I think. And it's doing a all-sky survey to find exoplanets. And I hope people can see this video. And it has 4 cameras, which collectively span about 96 degrees. And then they stare at this patch of the sky, as is shown over here, for 27 days before tiling and moving to the next patch of the sky. So basically, this is synced to lunar orbit. So a lunar orbit is about 27 odd days, and that's what the mission looks like. So we have that. And once it does one sector, which is shown over here with the 4 squares, it's tiling the sky. So it does one hemisphere at a time, which takes 1 year. And then it moves to the north. So it started in the south and it moved to the north, spending 1 month for every 24 degrees to cover the entire night sky. And there are certain regions where they overlap. So you have continuous coverage year round. So it basically did this for 2 years to cover the entire sky. And then it repeated this mission. So there was the prime mission, which lasted 2 years. And there was the extended mission two. And then very soon, there's going to be an extended mission 3. So we're getting this spacecraft to stare at pretty much the entire night sky. I say pretty much because it doesn't cover 100% of the night sky. You can see there are certain gaps. But for all intents and purposes, it's looking at the entire night sky. And this is really a key to finding planets, transiting planets, because it's staring at the star, it's measuring its brightness, and it's able to measure those dips in brightness, which correspond to potentially planet candidates are transiting in front of its host star. So with this, if you remember this plot from earlier on how many of these giant planets we know, you can see that the number of planets has increased by a lot. So earlier where we had 3 of them, now the number is perhaps closer to 20. And the work we have done as part of the GEMS survey is shown in orange. Whereas other members of the community have also made valuable contributions. And this is definitely a collective effort by not just our team, but also the community in finding these objects. So let me spend a few minutes talking about a couple of these objects, which I think I find very, very interesting. So one of them is TOI 5205. which was dubbed the Forbidden Planet when we found it. And the reason for that is because when we discovered this object, we only measured its radius, its mass. It turned out to be a very, very interesting anomaly in terms of how massive the object was compared to the mass of the host star. So essentially, this is about a 0.3% mass ratio, which doesn't sound like much. But when you think about it, it corresponds to a really, really massive amount of, a really large amount of material, a lot of hydrogen, a lot of helium, a lot of metals that are required to form this planet around a star that is just about 40% the mass of the sun. And what that means is that to form this planet, there are certain problems. If we basically take our current theory of planet formation, there are certain problems that we need to reconcile. And the reason for that is, first of all, it takes longer to form planets around M dwarf stars. But more importantly, because the stars are somewhat smaller, in this case, about 40% the mass of the sun, we expect that the disks, the protoplanetary disks in which these stars form, in which these planets form, to be lower in mass. And for all intents and purposes, we expect to be in approximately linear relationship. So these disks are much more lower in mass. So basically, there's lesser material to form these planets. So the question is, if there is so much lesser material, and here by material, I think the key problem is the dust, the metal. So I'm going to adopt like the astronomer definition, which is basically everything that's not hydrogen, helium, is a metal, is dust in the disk. So it's a very approximate, but it causes errors in the order of maybe 10%, which is not a huge amount when we consider that the uncertainties in these quantities are like a factor of 10 or 100. So many, many orders of magnitude larger. But coming back to the problem, which is the fact that the disks do not have enough material to form these planets. You need disks that are much more massive, or you need the efficiency to be greater than 100%, which is not possible. So there's something lacking in our understanding of planet formation that was basically uncovered by the discovery of planets like 5205, and then recently other planets like that. So this has been really interesting to identify the shortcomings, because this is such an extreme regime, as I keep saying, because the stars are so much smaller, but the planets are so much more massive that we are basically doing our best to break our current theories or hypotheses of planet formation. This is like a very extreme edge case. Another example that I would like to talk about is this object that was dubbed the Marshmallow Planet. So this is a object that's about the a planet that's about the size of Jupiter, but its mass is about a quarter that of Jupiter. So essentially, when it comes to the density of the planet, when it comes to the lowest density planet in the solar system, which is Saturn, it's about 0.8 grams per centimeter cube. But this object, 3757, which is orbiting an M dwarf, so therefore it's fairly cold. It's not that hot. But at the same time, it's still very, very low in density. It's about a third the density of Saturn. In fact, it's so low that the density somehow corresponds to the density for marshmallow. So somebody apparently did the calculation to figure out what's the density for marshmallow and started comparing it to the density of planets. So that's how this was dubbed, the marshmallow planet. And the question is, how do you take a ball of hydrogen helium with very little mass, because it's just a quarter the mass of Jupiter, but not let it condense onto itself? So it's still holding on to the radius of about Jupiter. So what's keeping it afloat? What's making it hold on to that large radii without contracting? Which is the key mystery when it comes to this planet. So as I said, I mentioned two planets. And I think the key question that I keep coming back to is, how did these objects form? How did these giant exoplanets and M dwarf stars form? And to make sure everybody's on the same page, let me just take a couple minutes to go over the process of planet formation. And folks here might already be aware of this, so I apologize if this is like a repetition. But just in case there's anybody in the audience who's not, let me just spend a few minutes going over this. The stars form in these giant molecular clouds, these globular clouds, which is basically where you have a density perturbation, which is slightly more dense than the rest of the cloud. It starts to collapse on itself. Soon it clears out a gap, which is what we are seeing over here, where the gas is falling into the cloud. Eventually, due to the conservation of angular momentum, the gas collapses into a disk, as you can see over here, which is the class one stage of planet formation. And as you can see, so you have a disk, but it's very flared. So it has these flared shapes. So it's like a frisbee, but at the same time flared. Then as time goes on, most of the gas falls onto the star or is blown away. And then what you're left with is basically just a frisbee, a flat, for all intents and purposes, a plane of dust and gas. And that's the protoplanetary phase of planet formation. Eventually, you lose all the gas as well, and you just have some dust left over. So for the longest time, we used to think that planets formed in the class two phase of planet formation, in the protoplanetary disk phase. But then Alan Boss at Carnegie proposed that maybe when it comes to giant planets, the shortcomings in the theory of planet formation that persisted for protoplanetary disk formation could be solved if we invoke planets to form not at the class two phase, but perhaps much earlier in the class one phase or class zero even, using the theory of gravitational instability. So where we have these disks, if there are slight regions in the disk that are more dense than others, and if the disk is cold enough, then those density perturbations can basically keep on accreting more and more gas till the point that they start to form planets in certain cases, and they get massive enough that they can form these giant planets. So that's the gravitational instability model of formation. Whereas the conventional model is the core accretion, where you have a really metal-rich ball, basically about, let's say, 10 to 15 Earth masses. And when it reaches a critical threshold, it can start to accrete gas very, very quickly. And then at a certain point, it reaches this runaway phase where basically it's exponentially increasing its mass because it's just eating up all the gas in its neighborhood. The problem with this conventional formation model has always been the time scale. It takes too long to form this core around an M dwarf, and it takes too long to initiate this runaway gaseous process before the disk goes away, before the disk vanishes because it's eaten up by the star. So what we are trying to do is see if we can explain the formation of these gems, these giant exoplanets, with the conventional model, the core accretion model. And one way to do that is if we measure these protoplanetary disks. If we go out, use radio telescopes, microwave telescopes like ALMA and VLA, and measure the amount of dust present in these disks. So what this plot is showing on the y-axis is the dust or the solids in the planets and in the disks. So the planets are shown with green, the M dwarf planets are shown with the green triangles, and the disks are shown with the orange bar. And what we are seeing that right now, it seems like the disks do not have enough material to form these planets. To form these planets, these disks need to be somewhere over here where this green text lies. So we need these disks to be a lot more massive to form M dwarf giant planets. So if our methods are wrong, or rather they're inaccurate, so to the point that they're underestimating the disk dust masses, the amount of metals in the disk, by like a factor of 10, then you could explain these objects through core accretion. And that's not entirely unreasonable, because very preliminary analysis has suggested that our methods are extremely limited when it comes to measuring disk dust masses and are underestimating the amount of dust there. The other thing could be that we are overestimating the amount of metals in the planets. So what we now know from Jupiter and Saturn and the Jura and Cassini mission is that these planets are very, very, very complex. So we used to think they have a solid metal core and then just a ball of hydrogen on top of that, hydrogen and helium. But what we now know based on Jupiter, Juno and Cassini is that they just have a lot more going on. They have a fuzzy core that is predominantly metal, but at the same time, they have some metallic hydrogen because the hydrogen is dense enough that it can conduct electricity. What that means is that might be partially responsible for giving them the magnetic field. At a certain pressure, helium is no longer soluble in hydrogen, so it starts condensing down, which might lead to helium rain. And then you have all other things like methane and ammonia in these atmospheres, which basically say that even the solar system giant, which are perhaps our best studied giant exoplanets, are extremely complex. And we don't really know what's going on inside them at the moment. And if we are trying to build upon the solar system giant planet models and extrapolate them to the extrasolar giant planets, there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And if we cannot reconcile the theory, then I think it comes to, can we explain these planets through gravitational instability, through GI? So I did some work with Alan Boss, who was kind enough to run some of his models to predict how easy is it to form these giant exoplanets around M dwarfs by this method. And what we see over here is that we start to see some of these clumps forming in these disks if the disks are really, really massive. So if the disks are about 10 to 20 to 30% the mass of the host star in the early stages of planet formation, so like in the class zero or one phase, it's not entirely unreasonable. We used to think that these types of disks don't exist. I guess I don't have that plot right now. But very recent radio telescope measurements have shown that in the early phases when the star is still condensing and forming the disks can be very massive. And these massive disks are not entirely unreasonable. You can't really have these disks which are cold and massive enough they can become unstable and form planets this way. So the question is, if I'm telling you that we are finding planets that are hard to explain through core accretion, while we can explain them through GI, are we basically saying that's what's going on? Do we know for a fact that these planets are forming through gravitational instability? And I think that's where the power of statistics comes in. We cannot just look at individual planets and just say that you cannot form this one object, and that means that all of these objects form through gravitational instability and core accretion is basically dead in the water. I think the true answer is perhaps a little more nuanced than that. And therefore, I think what we need to do is see how the GEMs, the giant exoplanets and M-dwarf stars, differ from their compatriots around FGK stars, around the solar type stars. And what we are starting to see is that there's a smooth trend in the mass of these objects. So when it comes to giant exoplanets, what's the most massive giant exoplanet you have around a given type star? You're seeing this very clean linear trend. If I just plot the sample, don't do any fancy statistics, just plot the sample. Another way to think about this is if you have the sun and a giant exoplanet around it, the most massive object, most massive planetary object you can have is lower in mass around an M dwarf than the solar type star, which perhaps doesn't sound too surprising. If you have a lower mass star, there's lesser material, it's perhaps not too surprising that the object forming around it is lower in mass. But the other way to think about this is if I start to use those non-parametric statistics, those mass radius relationships, which are now expanded to higher dimensions, we see very similar trends. So this is a bit of a complicated plot. So let me take a few seconds to explain this. And I'm basically suggesting that if I take a planet, which is the radius of Jupiter, and it's orbiting a range of stars ranging from about 1.3 solar masses to about half the mass of the sun, with the different stellar masses shown with the colors, we see that the predicted mass based on the sample follows almost a linear trend. So the other way to say this is the expected, the average value for a Jupiter-sized object around the sun is much more than a Jupiter-sized object around an M-dwarf. So all of this is to say that M-dwarf Jupiters exist, but they are lower in mass. They're much lighter than similar Jupiters around the sun, which I think is very, very symbiotic with our understanding of core accretion. If you're forming objects in the disk, if the disk is lower in mass because the star is lower in mass, then you just expect there to be lesser material present to form the planets. So this is weird dichotomy that the sample is telling us that the objects are compatible with core accretion. But at the same time, we are finding these unique objects which are completely breaking the bank when it comes to the mass budget. So what's the reconciliation here? And I think that's what we're trying to do with the GEMS survey, because we don't want to rely on just this one or two outliers, which might be outliers, which might not be outliers. But what we're trying to do is provide a larger sample. We can perform this comparison. We also want to study what is the metallicity dependence of how metal rich is the host star that hosts these giant planets, because that is one of the hallmarks, one of the key distinct identifiers when it comes to the formation mechanisms. So that's going to be one clue. But I think what the key is going to be is that in the next 5 years, we have missions like TESS. We have the European Space Agency launching the Plato mission, And then we have the ground-based radial velocities that I work on. So we want to combine these and find these planets, measure their masses. But as you can imagine, the transiting planets are very close to their host star. And the key thing to understand is they're missing 90%, perhaps 95% of the exoplanets out there, because they're just really sensitive to the close-by objects. So they're not sensitive to objects like Jupiter or Saturn or even Earth, because they're at much further orbital separations where you cannot really have a lot of them transiting. So what we want to try and do with this survey is build up a sample in the next 5 years of these transiting planets in time for the radial velocity detections, which are further away and shown in these triangles, in time for the astrometric detection. So we are finding objects by measuring the wobble in the plane of the sky by missions like the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite, which is expected to find about 10,000 planets in the green wedge that I show over here. The expectation for this is to be sometime in the late 2020s, perhaps closer to 2027 or so. So this will really fill in. So if we can fill in this orange region with our survey and then build up the sample with green, with the green region with Gaia, and then finally with the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which will fill in the region in blue through microlensing and transits as well. So that's the ultimate goal of this survey, to combine these different detection techniques and fill in this orbital separation axis such that right now the objects we're finding are not like the solar system. And we know that's a shortcoming of the technique. But the goal is to hone our detection techniques, our statistical techniques, and our theoretical models, which are also severely lacking, based on these planets, such that when we start to find other planets using these other techniques, which will come up soon, we can basically hit the ground running. And then finally, I also show on the top the US Extremely Large Telescope Program, which is basically going to be sometime in the late 2030s or mid-2030s, which can then directly image these planets. That'll basically be the goal. So you can not just find these planets, but you can block the host star, so you can directly image the planet and get light from it and measure its atmosphere directly. So that's the long-term goal of this survey. But what does that look like in the present? In the present, what we are doing is using data from the TESS mission, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, and observing about 1 million M-dwarfs. So we really need a really, really large sample because these objects are very, very rare. So after observing about 1 million M-dwarfs, I think our most conservative scenario is that we find about 100 of these planets. And that's basically the scale of the problem. So we need to go for about a factor of 10 to 4. So for every planet we need to find, we need to look at about 10,000 stars. And luckily, TESS is already doing that. It's just a matter of looking at the data in a statistically rigorous manner, and then we can determine how many planets there are. We can measure their masses, and then we can do a whole bunch of different science. We can measure their atmospheres. We can use statistics. We can measure their obliquities. And I think for the last 5 minutes, I'm going to focus on the atmospheres, which is basically that once you have the mass of the object, you can start to basically try and apply for telescope time on the James Webb Space Telescope and future missions like that, which can determine the atmospheric composition of these planets. And maybe that's what holds the key. Right now, I suggested that just the mass and radii sometimes do not give us the full picture because these objects are so complex. So maybe we can measure their atmospheres. And that's what we're trying to do over here. So we have a recently accepted, I shouldn't say recently, we've started getting our observations now. So we have three transits already. And in fact, the next transit is going to be on Monday. So it's extremely exciting. So we are going to study 7 of these gems, giant exoplanets, for 18 transits and determine how much metal is in their atmosphere. So how much hydrogen, how much of the atmospheres is not hydrogen, helium, but perhaps water, which is a proxy for oxygen? How much of their atmospheres is methane, which is a proxy for carbon? To see if we can connect that to what we know about the solar system, what we know about FGK giant planets, such that we can bridge the gap between the two. So I think I'm running out of time. I should say it's not right now, but it's on Monday. So let me move forward. And I think I'll finally just mention that we're going to use these really new models that are developed by our collaborators in Zurich, which will try to basically put all of these pieces together. So we have the radius from TESS, we have the mass from these RV spectrographs, we have the atmospheric information from JWST. And with a bunch of magic and models, we can start to form better, get a better picture into what the planetary interiors look like. So with that, these are the seven planets. And if people are interested, I can come back to this slide, but I won't go into all these numbers right now. I will leave up my conclusions, which are basically the fact that these stars are really, really cold, both literally and metaphorically. They're really cool. And these giant exoplanets are starting to stretch our understanding of planet formation. I think this is a very exciting time which we live in, where we are starting to not just find the planets, but with instruments like JWST and other ground-based instrumentation, we can characterize their bulk and atmospheric composition. So hopefully, maybe I can come back in a few years and tell you what we have found about these exoplanets and how they form, how they are different, and what's going on with the stars. And with that, I will stop and take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see what kind of questions we have out there.
You can always go ahead.
So I have one little question. This new instrumentation, those graphs, I assume that's showing where light or radiation gets through our atmosphere and where it does not?
Yes. No, well, I guess I have two parts. So the blue is the sun. And yeah, so the blue is the spectral energy distribution of the sun. And in the visible, I think for the most part, we can ignore any atmospheric absorption because the atmosphere is pretty transparent in the visible. But there are certain molecular bands, for example, with oxygen, with water, even in the visible, where there are certain absorption features. When it comes to the near infrared, I haven't included the atmospheric absorption over here. So that's a very good point. So there's a region about 900 to a micron, 900 nanometers to about a micron, where there's a lot of water vapor in the atmosphere, or at least the water molecular absorption is in that region. So we cannot get a lot of information from the host star in that region. And most of the light is basically absorbed by the atmosphere. So I would say, in fact, there are these pockets. I guess that's a better way to think about it. So in the photometric, we have the YJHK bands. So those are the pockets in which we are getting the spectrum as well. So the YJH bands.
Okay. Thank you. Harold, do you have a question?
Not that I can think of at the moment. It was a wonderful talk, though.
Thank you.
I think it really is interesting, fascinating times that we have so much information on so many exoplanets. And it wasn't that long ago that most people thought we would never detect any. And now we've got thousands, and we have enough populations to at least theorize about how they all formed. And I'm thinking back that the very first exoplanets were really, really big and really, really close to the star that they were orbiting. And people were thinking, is that all the other ones? And now we know that's not like that at all.
Absolutely. Yeah, most of the systems we have found are not like the solar system. So I think that still remains an elusive goal to find solar system-like planetary systems.
Yes,
if I may, what is the significance of the greater metallicity in these gems?
Sorry, do you mean the metallicity of the star or the metallicity of the planet?
The metallicity of the exoplanets.
Excellent question. Yeah, so I definitely kind of brushed that under the rug. So thank you for bringing that up. So let me go back to the mass radius relationship, right? So we have the mass and radius of the object, and that's like a first order proxy for its density. Now, with just the mass and radius, I can basically 4 by 3 pi r cube is its volume. M by volume is its density. And that's the best we can do. We can predict the density of the object and try to compare that with some models. So it's about 50% water, maybe it's 70% rock, maybe it's 90% hydrogen, helium, and 10% metals, or so on. So that's an estimate of its bulk metallicity. But what we're seeing is that these objects are not a homogeneous ball of hydrogen, helium, with some metals interspersed in their bulk. They're a lot more complex than that, based on what we have seen for Jupiter and Saturn, right? So the key comes to how can we take the lessons learned from Jupiter and Saturn, which are extremely complex objects and basically represent the best hope of understanding exoplanets or giant planets in general. And how do we apply them to these exoplanets where we can never launch satellites to go in situ, like Cassini went inside Jupiter, like Juno is orbiting, Cassini went inside Saturn and Jupiter's being orbited by Juno. We can never do that for these exoplanets. So how do we apply the lessons learned from our solar system to the exoplanets? And one way to do that is by their metallicity distribution. So if we can measure the metallicity of the atmospheres, it's going to basically tell us how much metal and how much hydrogen is there in the atmosphere, and how much of elements that are not hydrogen are in its atmosphere. And that can be used as a first order proxy for the interior structure models, which is what we're trying to do over here, to determine how did the planet evolve, and more importantly, how much is its bulk metallicity, how much dust is in the planet. So if the planet is extremely bulk metal rich, it means it has a lot of dust and non-hydrogen helium, which means it formed in a disk that had to have a lot of dust in it. So basically, what we're trying to do is go from measuring the planet today to trying to connect to the environment in which it formed. If a planet does not have a lot of metals, then the disk in which it formed presumably did not have a lot of metals. So that's what we're trying to do, see if there are trends based on the metallicity.
What if you could further establish this, what can you extrapolate out towards the formation of possibly habitable planets in the habitable zone? Can you make any connection?
That's an excellent question. So excuse me. When we measure the hydrogen helium, and when we measure the non-hydrogen helium, as importantly, in these atmospheres, we can start to understand the environment in which these planets form. Now, we haven't yet detected a true Earth analog around the solar type star. The detection amplitude of an Earth-like planet is extremely small. We haven't detected it. We have detected a few habitable zone planets around M dwarfs. I'm not saying they're habitable, but they do exist in the region, which at least the equilibrium temperature suggests that they could be habitable. Mm-hmm. Some of our giant planets exist in temperature regimes which are close to that. I wouldn't say they're in the habitable zone, but they start to get close to that. Now, the jump we are making is, if the ultimate goal is to find habitable planets and understand how they form, et cetera, we don't have any of those around the sun. We have habitable zone planets around M dwarf stars. But even around M dwarf stars, because the stars are so active, and as John was mentioning earlier, these are like the two-year-old equivalent to an adult. The stars are extremely active. They have a lot of spots. They have a lot of flaring. It's not that trivial to study the atmosphere of these planets orbiting M dwarf stars. The next best thing we can actually do is study the atmospheres of giant exoplanets orbiting these types of stars. So what we're trying to do here is not just get an understanding of how giant planets form, but get a picture of what the inside of these planets look like, connect that to what the disks look like in which these planets form, which presumably are similar to the disks in which habitable zone planets around the M dwarfs form. Because there are theories that suggest that M dwarf planets should be volatile rich. There are theories that suggest they should be volatile poor. I think our theorist friends can come up with basically all kinds of explanations because there's so much that's unknown. So it's really the onus lies on observational astronomers to figure out what's going on and tell us which region of parameter space do these spans exist? And that's what we're trying to do here.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay, are there other questions?
A quick question. Are those shell spectrographs?
Absolutely, yes. They are shell spectrographs, yes. I don't have a... Let me see if I have a layout of the... Oops. But yes, they are 100% the shell spectrographs because they have spectral resolutions on the order of about... For HPF, it's about 60,000. For NUET, it's about 120,000. I was just trying to get this screen. So you can see that the spectrum you are seeing in the 2D is because it's in a shell spectrum. Yep, absolutely.
That's why I was asking. I saw that
yep. there. And so yeah, and the gray thing, for example, with NUET is lying in here. I don't know if you can see the cursor. Yeah. And in HPF, the gray thing is in this mount.
Thank you. Wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we can unmute and clap.
Yes. Thank you very much. Survive.
That was a really terrific talk.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Thanks again. Anybody have any last announcements before we close down?
So just a reminder that the meeting next month will be, in theory, hybrid, unless something changes or whatever. Is that correct, John? Is the speaker planning on being in person?
I think so.
Okay.
The speakers generally prefer that.
Okay. And so, Shubham, you're more than welcome to come to next month's meeting if you want to see the observatory. And then just, or give me a ring anytime, and we'll get you out to check it out. When I'm back in town, I'm thawed out here in St. Croix and enjoying the warm weather. So.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, we're freezing here and soon be colder.
Well, enjoy it is January. It's supposed to be cold.
Yeah, it is wintertime.
I'd like to thank Elizabeth for dealing with all of the mess involved with the website. I know that's a stressful thing to deal with, and we appreciate it.
And no problem. A little bit of it was my fault, but it was the hosting service was not making it easy either. So, there'll be more on that later on. So
we all owe Elizabeth a great
deal.
Thanks.
All is good.
Yes, we do.
All is good. So, okay.
And Todd for putting out an excellent
absolutely,
newsletter.
Yes.
Amen.
Yes.
Okay. Well, good night, everybody.
Good
night. And I'm going to go out and do some.